Start that over. Give a little headspace. Hey, everybody, and welcome to Pro Photo Show. It is September the 24th, 2015. Good to be back.
Welcome to Pro Photo Show, the resource for professional and enthusiast photographers, a member of the Blueberry Network and the Tech Podcast Network. For show notes, tips, forums, and more, visit us online at profotoshow.net.
Pro Photo Show is still here. We're getting out an episode every few months, and today we have a teeny tiny round table panel. We're broadcasting live right now on the Photographic School YouTube channel. So if you're not subscribed to that, head over there, because one of the things that I've been doing when podcasts aren't coming out is we're making more video content and trying to kind of bring in the visual aspect more. And that's actually been going on the Photographic School channel in between when we have Pro Photo Show episodes and things like that. So definitely head over to YouTube/Photographic School and check that out. This episode's brought to you by the new Autumn Light presets from SimeEffects.com. Check them out at SimeEffects.com. The new limited edition presets for Lightroom made specifically for the beautiful fall color that we're coming into right now, unless you are our esteemed guest, Mr. Jason Eldridge.
Hello, I am all the way down in South Florida, and we have one tree that sort of turns brown and loses its needles, the cypress tree, and that's pretty much our fall color
and
here.
Everybody sees that, and they're like, wow, fall, isn't it beautiful? Here's the challenge for you, Jason, is you have the one tree, so make it work. You know, that's part of being a professional is that you got to go over and above, and so you got to bring out that beautiful fall color on the cypress tree. I'm going to do a Google search right now, fall in Florida, and see if it's a thing. Now, let me see. Now, I'm getting photos coming up that have beautiful fall color, but maybe they're not actually in Florida.
Yeah, they could be in North Florida, which is 1 hour away.
Maybe people are faking it too. You never know. We could have some of that going on. Let's see. Okay, so fall in Florida. I see girls in bikinis. That seems to be a common theme in Florida. I do see some color here. Maybe this is the cypress tree the one that has the moss hanging down from it?
No, not necessarily. That's being the Spanish moss. The cypress tree grows in standing water, and it widens at the trunk, and it's usually dark right above the water where it absorbs.
Gotcha. Cypress tree in fall. Okay. Yes. Here's what I'm thinking before we kind of jump into this show. By the way, our topic for today, guys, is going to be fall and what we're going to do this fall, what's happening with gear this year in 2015, where photography has been going these days. Even though we got a small panel, we're going to have some fun. We're going to share some tips, and we're trying to get Jason inspired here. I think he's a little under the weather today. There's probably it's interesting to me. Apparently, you get colds in Florida, even though there's no cold down there.
We only get colds in Florida once every couple of years or once a year when I'm invited to a podcast. Other than that, I'm pretty well okay.
You're pretty good to go. Okay, so I'm looking at this cypress tree. Here's what I'm thinking. Jason's telling me, well, the cypress tree is boring and it doesn't make for a very exciting fall imagery. Isn't that what we have hue for? You know, what was once brown can now be orange. In fact, you know what? Since we're on that topic, the new Autumn Light presets from SimeEffects have presets that are designed for when you really nail that perfect fall color. But it's a set of presets designed around fall color. And there are some that are designed to kind of turn summer into fall and that use some of the magic of hue to take those yellows and browns and bring them into the reds and the oranges. So maybe a few of our Autumn Light presets will help get you going, Jason, and turn some of that cypress color into award-winning fall imagery. I really do. I'm looking at some of these images, and I see the brown you're talking about, but you know what? Color is color, and you mix green with brown, and you get good light. Brown, and I'm being serious right now, brown, you get a golden sunset on brown, and I think there's some potential out there. Maybe you're missing out a little on what could be happening out in the swamps in the fall.
Oh, well, I don't let the fact that they're brown stop me from going.
So
I go often and I walk into the Cypress Domes and I do all that stuff. So if I I'll be going probably in the next week or two. So as Very I cool. get a chance, the images that I take, I'll have brown in them and then I can work with it from there.
Awesome. Cool. Okay. Well, Jason, it's been a while since we've had a show. Let's give a few updates and kind of bring people up to speed on some of what we're seeing in the photography world. But tell us, give us an update with you, because it's been a little while since you've been on the show. And tell us what you're up to, what you're doing with photography, and kind of what how you're feeling about all this. Not how are you feeling right now with a little bit of a head cold going on, but just in general, what's happening with you?
Quite a bit, actually, since the last show. I'm now the president of the South Florida National Parks Camera Club.
Cool.
And we started with just a couple of members, and now I think we're up to 60 or 61 members. It's grown tremendously over the past year. I've got the corporation up and running. I've gotten insurance. I'm now a licensed guide in the Everglades to take people in to do Very photography. Cool. Or to walk into the places like the Cypress Domes that aren't necessarily advertised by the park services.
So I'm just trying to be clear on that. Then you can go in and like lead workshops, for example, in the park without getting hassled by the man. Is that the idea?
That is correct.
Very cool. Well, that's always nice. And I've looked into that, doing that in here. And let's quite frankly, dealing with the National Park Service is not my favorite thing to do on those kind of things. And it can be a real pain. So that could be handy. It gets on my nerves that I have to ask permission to use land that I already own. But if you're going to be teaching workshops and stuff, you want to be able to focus on those students and be able to give them what they need.
Yeah, and overall, it was, at least here, it was an easier process, I would think, than other places, because the Everglades, they don't get a lot of money. So they don't get a lot from the government. They don't get a lot of traffic like Great Smoky Mountains does, right. Nothing like that at all. I think we had maybe 1 million visitors last year, which is almost...
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, because I looked at like doing, hey, what if I do one of my light workshops and take them into Mount Rainier or something like that? And so I contacted them and they wanted me to pay all these application fees that were non-refundable. And they had to do like, you know, what I was going to be doing and where I was going to be doing and environmental impact and all that. And I'm just like, you got to be kidding me. I'm just going to go out and find somewhere pretty and do that with them. I'm not playing your game. So...
For us down here, it was, hey, yes, I'm insured. I added you as one of the insured. Here's my $250. And they said, okay, you're good for the year.
That's a whole different animal. Yeah. No, they were wanting me to do like, you had to do this like every time for every workshop. It was goofy. But anyways, I'll try not to rant too much about about the federal government, because I could go on all day about that. But tell us what else you're up to.
Let's see. Over the past year, I've sold the largest print that I've ever done. It was 90 inches wide.
Awesome.
It was a nice panoramic. It was to a law firm here in Miami. They wanted it on metal, so that was unusual.
Yeah.
But it was a fantastic sale, and since then I've done headshots for one of the partners and just recently sold another print to one of the partners of the same firm.
Oh, really? Very cool.
Been doing that. I've kind of been staying away from portraits and weddings. I've got one wedding coming up this Saturday, likely to be my last one. I got into photography because of nature and wildlife, and I kind of veered from that when I got down to South Florida and I missed my mountains, and
right.
I didn't give the Everglades the fair shake that I should have. So I got into portraits and weddings, but now I'm kind of going back and getting my feet wet, so to speak.
Expanding your Everglade horizons, and there's lots of them out there. It seems like there's a ton of potential if you're willing to be eaten by crocodiles.
That's alligators. Actually, we have some saltwater crocs down here. But
so do you ever wrestle alligators while you're out there or anything like that?
Not wrestle them, but you always have to be aware of them because you're there in their environment.
Have you ever had any close calls or really creepy situations out there?
Creepy, absolutely. I've not had any close calls, but I'd wanted to go into Cypress Dome forever, and I decided to go in by myself. So I'm going into a place that I don't know anything about. So creepy is definitely a factor, because when anything moves and you're out in an unfamiliar area,
right?
imagination.
And, yeah, wow. Exactly. And the Everglades seems like one of those places. I mean, it's like the trees and the moss hanging down. It's like, it's, it seems like one of those places where once it gets dark, you're like, well, I'm pretty much going to be eaten by a creature.
That's right. That's right. It took a good bit of time for me to get my confidence to go in there. But it turns out that through knowledge and study and research, and I was able to figure out all of this stuff, and I know the environment, I know what the critters are going to do and what kind of critters are there and what to watch out for and all the preparation that I need, I can confidently walk in now.
Now, are you leading any workshops or anything to the Everglades yet, or is that kind of in the future plans? Or
I've led a couple of field trips with the group that we've got. I've led some of those, and I've got a workshop coming up in December. I've got 4 slots left in it.
Excellent.
That I'm going to be taking some folks in.
And where can people learn more about that?
At eldridgephoto.com.
Awesome. Okay, very cool. A nice little update from my end. You know, I kind of gave people an update on the last episode a couple months ago here, but now the summer has passed, and the summer was good. I've kept really busy, and I got to do a really neat road trip. I think the last podcast was recorded shortly before my summer road trip. I got to spend a couple weeks on the road. We hit Yellowstone. We hit Tetons. And it was really nice to just get out. I've had a really busy year. Ever since running for Congress in 2014, I've been really involved in political activism, and sometimes very tenaciously so. And sometimes it makes people angry when they see me on the news and the things that I'm bringing up, and the liberty concerns and the constitutional concerns. And that's just who I am. And it's really nice. It was really neat this summer to get out and really get back to decompressing and taking the road trip and seeing some beautiful landscapes. Haven't done a lot for portrait work, a little bit of wedding stuff here and there, but really what I'm focusing on in my photography is building now the educational series that I have, things like Exposed and Photographics, and a couple of new workshops like the Sliders workshop that we released this year over at Sime Effects, and of course the new presets and tools like that, and really just trying to expand the craft as I build my own landscape portfolio. And as I think both of us know, Jason, it's one thing to photograph landscapes, and it's another thing to build a brand and make them a really profitable brand. And that's still my long-term goal. I know I've been talking about that for 5 years, and I'll probably be talking about it for another decade to come before I really get everything nailed down. And what I'm finding is as I study and teach and try to refine ideas and my understanding of light and raise the bar, that I keep setting the standard higher for myself and saying, well, I want to do more. I really need to narrow down on what is a Gavin Sime image going to be. Let's make those museum quality pieces and do more than just make photographs. I want to make heirlooms. And the truth is, in my studio right here, I'm kind of running out of wall space for the scale of the prints that I want to be doing now and some of the new stuff I'm working on. I did an image that I finally finished this year from Zion National Park. And I think I mentioned this one, but it's one of our great camp spots out near Zion where it overlooks the whole Zion Basin. And I haven't officially released it publicly yet, so I'm going to have to get it out there soon. But it is a stitch panorama. I went back to that spot for about 4 years, 3 or 4 years to get this image. And the light and the clouds and the sky were never quite right. And I finally just got it perfect. The light was right. The sunset was there. I had the incoming storm that I had waited for years for. And I've got this panorama that is just absolutely beautiful. And I'm really excited about it. And we're going to be looking at a master original on that of probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 130 inches. And so I'm just looking around thinking, where am I going to put this unless I pre-sell it to somebody? And really excited about that, but basically bringing back to that topic of I'm studying the craft more and more and deeper and trying to raise the bar on that and really find ways to do more than just take pictures. We want to put something spectacular on the wall. I'm looking back to the masters and how the work is revered and collectible now and thinking, okay, how can we not only build our craft and our ability, but also build the quality of the images we make, the marketability of the images we make, and all that stuff. I'm just going to real quick here, Jason, and for those watching in the live stream, do you see my screen? Is it coming up there?
Yes.
This is probably going to be inadequate to doing this justice, but here's this new one. And I don't know if it's showing up there or not.
Yes, that's fantastic.
But and let me just zoom in, because the really cool part, and I know it's not going to do it justice here, this is a 35,000 pixel wide image. And the detail is just wonderful.
How many shots? That's my question.
What's that?
How many shots did you take for that?
I think it's only about 12, maybe 15 or something like that. But basically, it's a row across. And I just used the Mark II for this. I didn't do the 4x5 because I knew I needed that really wide image. The light was very fleeting. So we actually pulled in. And this, I took this on the fall 2013 trip when we were out finishing photographic. So I had my brother and we've been out filming, and so it's been a while since I took the image, and then it took a lot of work, and I really wanted to take my time in stitching it and putting it together and post-processing it, not because I was doing intensive processing, but I wanted to make sure I didn't screw this one up and that I really had time to do it. And last year was just crazy for me. I didn't have a lot of time to do anything last year. And so we've got an image here that is, and I'll try and link this in the show notes for those that aren't watching live, but what I'm going to do is put a sectioned off one or something where people can zoom in and post it to the site. I forget, Zoomify, I think we call that. But this is 30. The output resolution on this is about 26,000 by 4,700. So a lot of megapixels, a lot of detail. And you see, we got this great incoming storm over here, and there's detail all the way out into the cliffs. And it's just really going to make a great image. And we have, this is actually in the fall, so you have actually detail in the fall color in the trees down in the valley, and just overlooking the entire Zion Basin with that sweet golden red rock color that is unmistakable. I mean, there's nothing quite like it across the whole basin. So this is going to be a fun one for me. I just got to find out how to get the print to the scale that I need it to.
Yeah, somebody asked Bill Fortney one time, how do you get landscape shots like that? And I think there's a tip here, which is his tip was you go back to the same spot 40 times.
Right. And that was interesting, because I think I mentioned this spot on the podcast before, and it's up on the Smith Mesa down, not in the park, but kind of in that general region. And so we park the trailer up there, and we're literally like 20 feet from this cliff that overlooks the whole valley. It's one of the most breathtaking just public land camp spots that I've ever been on. And I kept coming back, and I would take photos every time we were there, and they never did it justice. I'd get up at sunrise, but the light was too into the camera. I'd come back at sunset, but while it was pretty, I mean, you get beautiful sunsets anytime the sun's out, because the sun goes down, it illuminates the red rock every night. But the problem is, I knew it wasn't enough because I didn't have a sky. I still had that blank, empty blue sky on the previous one. So I just waited and waited and waited. And we probably came back 4 or 5 times. And bear in mind, this is 1,000 miles from home. So it wasn't like I could just run down there every weekend. And it was probably the 4 or 5 times we came back before we finally got this image. And it was like we had been out scouting other places. We pulled in, the light was happening. I jumped out, I set it up, and I did the sequence. And here's one of the secrets of this shot is I took the images. I did the panorama. I double-checked my focus. I was tripoded, of course. I wasn't going to do anything that would cost me my quality. And I got the shots. I got the images. And then I went to look at them and just kind of do some test assemblies on them that night. And I found that I had made a mistake that you often do when you're doing a panorama and you get in a rush, is I had got all the cliffs. I got all the light and all the color. But on the bottom of the frame, I cropped it in a little too tight, especially when you compensate for sometimes you get a little panorama drift and you got to crop it up. And so I felt like it was too tight, and just the way the leading lines were, the image was great, but the leading lines down in the shadows weren't quite right. And so I was really frustrated with myself, even though I knew I had a good image. So what I did is at the exact same time the next night, even though the sunset wasn't as good the next night, we didn't have that incoming storm, what I did is I just photographed the foreground, the plateaus down there that were in the shadow, not that were in the sunlight. So what we have in the image is that sunset, and it's all the sunset from that night, but down in the shadow, the sliver on the bottom, I took in the same light at the same time of day in shadow, and then just brought those images in with the same processing to match, and gave myself some more crop space on the bottom. So that was, I guess you could call that a little cheater technique. I mean, what you're still seeing is the real sunset there, but that was a lesson learned that I need to always remind myself. And as much as I remind other people of this, I find myself falling into the same trap. You must leave yourself space. Don't crowd yourself. And especially with panoramas, leave space in the frame so you have room to work with.
Right. Yeah, there's only so much that Content Aware can do to fill in those places. I always go a little bit extra wide with panos just for that right. reason.
Give yourself more than you need.
Yeah.
Exactly. So anyways, what I've been doing over the summer is I've been getting some new landscape and got probably four or five new pieces to release this year. And if you go over to F164.com, you will see some of my postings. I'm kind of trying to get back in the groove of posting over there. And I just posted a really cool image from Yellowstone a couple days ago over on the F164 blog that I got when I was up there. And always love going to Yellowstone, even though it's one of those places that's heavily photographed. It's always a great trip. So I did that. I was able to get some really cool new videos, and just getting out in nature, in the environment that you really like to be in, whatever that environment is, and challenging yourself to do new things really helps to raise the bar. So kind of with the updates out of the way, I mean, this is what I'm doing. Here's what Jason's doing. And we're just plugging away. Let's talk a little bit about, since we have a small panel, we don't have any marketing gurus per se on here. Not that you and I aren't marketers, but we don't have any of the big wedding or portrait people that are really active on things right now on that front. So let's kind of take it into just what's been happening this year technologically, and not talk about the news so much, but what you're seeing. I mean, we have the Canon 5DS. We have a lot of people talking about the Sony A7 series. I'm really eyeing the 645Z medium format and looking at switching over to that. And so without going into every camera that came out this year, what are you seeing, Jason? What are you thinking? What are you shooting with right now? And where do you think you want to be going with it?
Right now I'm using Nikon D4, and I've had it for quite a bit of time now, and I have no intention of upgrading anytime soon because it's given me what I need right now. I would like more megapixels. I think that's kind of what Nikon users almost always say.
Right.
I like 810. I like it. I also like the new Canon camera that's coming out. I haven't seen any images from it yet. I like the increase in megapixels for it. The
right.
5S.
It's 50 megapixels. Yeah. Gotcha. Well, and I think it's funny because the megapixels always come up. And I remember when the 5D Mark II came out, we had the panel on and we were kind of all excited about it. And we're like, well, I'd never need 20 megapixels for a wedding. And, you know, we had all these back and forth debates we were doing with Barry and Dennis and all of us. And I've used that camera for years, and now the 5D Mark II, I mean, I think of it, and I say I have a 5D Mark II, and I'm like, should I be embarrassed? Because that's a pretty old camera, you know? And the reality is, I didn't upgrade to the 5D3. I didn't upgrade to everything else because they weren't really that significant of upgrades to me. I was looking at the output, and yes, they had features and speed and gadgets, but at the end of the day, it's not about how many toys or buttons a camera has. Even though I like the technology, it's about the output image that I can produce, and I never felt like it was increasing enough. Now Canon's come out with the 5DS, and so that's exciting. It was they finally answered the D800, and that's interesting to me because I would think with landscapes that you would be shooting a D800, and so that you're sticking with the D4 is fascinating. And now we have the Canon, and so I'm kind of eyeing, okay, where do we go? Because when we're making large prints, the megapixels, those of us trying to kind of step outside and escape the 8x10 and 11x14 rut and get into higher-end products to sell people, I think are saying, okay, where can I go? What did film offer? I mean, as you know, this is why I went to 4x5. So what do you think on the megapixels? I mean, you're working with 16 still. That's interesting.
I am. I have a huge desire to go to the 810, and I get to use my wife as a means to do that because she's doing underwater photography really heavy now with the big DSLR setups. She's
okay.
Still a D7000, so it's a little bit older of a camera, and I'm looking at getting her a D810 and housing. And then when she's not diving, that's what I'm going to be taking into the Everglades or the places.
Okay. Really, you're looking for a Trojan horse to pick up the D800.
Yes.
And what better Trojan horse than if your wife wants it?
And she does. So I'm very excited. So I see that in my future, probably next year or whatever iteration of the 800, 810, 820, or whatever they're going to come out with next year or the year after.
It occurs to me that Jason might be smarter than most of us because, you know, he said, well, let me get my wife into photography. I remember years ago when she first started shooting underwater stuff and she just started with some of the point and shoots and stuff. And I was thinking, oh, that's really cool. And she's just gone further and further. We're going to have her come on sometime to talk about this and talk about kind of that aspect that most of us haven't delved into. I've done a little underwater work with, you know, an Iwo Marine and doing portraiture, that kind of stuff, but it's very limited. It's certainly not my genre. And this is an interesting move because you're doing totally different work. So on the one hand, it's not really like, well, you know, you have to compete with each other. It's so different. You know, it's like, well, whose landscape is better? But at the same time, you have this wonderful opportunity to say, I think we need that.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And just as a little plug for her, if you go to KimEldridgePhoto.com, you'll be able to see some of her stuff there. And she's got some amazing work. She just got back from a trip to the Red Sea, awesome. Which is the top diving site on the planet. It's just beautiful. And she's working with Stephen Frink on a pretty regular basis now, who is the most published underwater photographer in the world, who lives in Fargo.
Yeah, I'm just looking at some of her stuff, and it's some really beautiful work that she does. So that's very cool. Now, is she printing a lot of this yet, or just building a portfolio? Or
she is building the portfolio. She has made one print, and it was the image of Stephen Frink with the dolphin, the bottlenose dolphin that were there.
Gotcha.
And had it framed and gave it to him, and he immediately took down whatever picture it was above his desk and plopped it in its place.
Excellent. Well, and I'm looking at these, and the sea has such – what I like about some of her work is it's not just, oh, look, there's coral reefs. I mean, like the jellyfish with the black background, and it's just kind of radiating light. And I think there's potential – I'd like to see, okay, what about underwater landscapes? And can we make those big like we would do with an Everglade? You know, why not make them 80 inches? Why not put them on canvas? And what's the potential there? Obviously, you know, it's a little more of a challenge if you're talking about close-ups of fish and stuff like that. And as beautiful as those are, what really I look at and get excited about is these wider scenes that have fish, that have colors, that have the blue, that have the black, that have the reds, where you really almost get this surreal landscape, but almost abstract kind of world.
She loves doing macro work, and she's working on wide angle a little bit more as it goes on. She's gotten so much better over the past year that it's leaps and bounds. So it's very astounding cool. Work she's doing. And I agree, the macro stuff everybody seems to really like because of the colors and the hidden fish, and it's pretty interesting to see that. And magazines, stuff like that, are interested in those as well. But as far as what you're talking about, the big prints, those aren't going to sell for big prints.
Thinking, you know, I'm back to my marketing concepts here of thinking, okay, how do we differentiate? And of course, you should do what you like, you know, and then find your market for that as much as possible. But I don't see, we have lots of landscape photographers, and so we're all struggling out there to kind of make our work rise above. But underwater landscapes, while they exist, of course, are not so much a thing, and it brings a whole new challenge into it.
Right. There's also not, it's not, the market's not flooded for underwater photography because there's a barrier to entry. You have to be able to dive. You have to get the housing and the big expensive probes and all of that. So for landscape underwater, there's a pretty good market for it because it's just not as common.
Well, and if you could pull off the detail, and I think a D800 series might really come in handy because it's still not super large, but you could get, you know, that really wide detail. And of course, you're dealing with the environmental factors of the water, which probably affect your detail sometimes as well. But that's really cool. We'll have to, rather than me musing about how it might work, we'll have to get her on sometime and discuss some tips on that.
I should love that.
Yeah, that'd be fun. But no, I think it's interesting. I think the 800 series is good. I mean, I think, okay, I'm using 20 megapixels and it's honestly not enough for me. And there's some articles about this on Pro Photo Show. A lot of my blogging is happening over on SimFX now. So there's some tips and stuff there. If you haven't gone to the SimFX blog lately, that's where a lot of my tips and things like that are going, new videos, that sort of thing, and freebies. And what I've been thinking about is the resolution. You know, I've talked about 4x5 for years now, and I've talked about, okay, the quality's great. And of course, I've learned a lot from that. And I've known from day one, well, it's not the most practical way to make images in terms of efficiency and cost and all that kind of stuff, but I still love to do it. But what I'm really eyeing is, okay, what's the next phase? And we're seeing things like the 5DS, and I'm going to actually do some serious image analysis. I looked at some of the early image releases, and the problem that a lot of us are concerned about and that often comes up is, well, you got so many pixels, it's full frame, but it's so many pixels, and now there's a lot of pixels crammed on that frame, and you're going to have more noise and artifacts. And so, yes, there's 50 megapixels, but, and so I'm going to analyze that. And no doubt the images are beautiful from it, but what I'm really eyeing is, okay, I might get a 5DS to kind of continue my landscape work and have that range, but I'm also really considering jumping into the medium format digital, using the Pentax 645Z as an entry point, because they're really bringing the barrier down. And I talked about this on the last show, I think, and I'm still very seriously considering that. They're bringing that barrier down of, okay, it is all this megapixels. It's not too big, but it's large compared to, you know, a compact, but it has this great big sensor that's basically the same kind of sensor as you're getting with your $30,000 systems. And so it seems like there's a ton of potential, and from what I'm reading about it, it's great. People are just loving it. And so I think for us landscape guys, this is something to really consider, because you have all that resolution, all that detail in a larger film plane, not film, but digital plane, as it were. So you're going to get a different perspective on the imagery. And then some other people say, well, you know, what about the A7 and all these things? So we're seeing various cameras from Sony, from Nikon, from Canon now, that are up into the 30, 40, 50 megapixel range. Finally, it took us years to get there. Where do we go from here?
You know, recently I was in Clyde Butcher's museum in right. Big Cypress, and I was walking around, and his prints are astounding and massive.
Right.
And I was in a section, I was walking around, and the attendant there came over and said, oh, by the way, these are his digital prints. He started taking digital images now, and he's using all Sony. And I was pretty amazed. Wow. Images that he got. I assume that he's doing a lot of panoramic work or multi images for stitching purposes to get the resolution he's getting.
Right. Interesting.
What I have to do with the D4 when I see landscapes is I'll do panos, or I'll do extra shots for stitching purposes.
Right. And so, yeah, I'll do that sometimes with the panos. I really don't like doing that if I'm not doing a pano, because now I'm distracted from my composition. And so then I'm thinking, okay, let's go to 4x5. Let's go to a larger camera, you know, let's go to a medium format. And so that's interesting. I've heard some really good things about what the Sony's got going on. I've heard kind of a lot of positive things about the Nikon. Still, the jury's kind of still out, I think, on the 5DS. And of course, I've heard phenomenal things about the Pentax 645Z in the medium format.
That up. I don't know anything about it, so that's interesting. What's the price point, entry price point?
It's about $8,000.
Well, that's not that much more than I paid for a D4.
So yeah. That might be some- I mean, of course, it's more than a D800 or a 5DS, but at the same time, you're getting that 50 megapixels. And what they did, so the 645D was a few years ago, I believe that was 40 megapixels, and the 645Z just came out last year, middle summer of 2014, I believe it was, and its availability is pretty solid now, and everything I'm reading about is people just say it's just amazing. Now, of course, it is medium format, so it's bigger, but it's not huge. People say it feels great in the hand. It handles well. 54 megapixels with ISO up to 204,000 on a 43 millimeter sensor. So, I mean, the potential here, I'm thinking, wow, there's so much potential for us landscape guys. And honestly, for my portraits too, because while it's not fast like a D-series, a Nikon or a Canon or something like that, it's 3 frames per second. I mean, it's going to be at least as fast as my 5D Mark II, good autofocus system. I mean, they really ramped it up, and it's at about $8,500. And of course, then you got the lenses and all that kind of stuff. But it's the body will adapt to a lot of the old Pentax lenses too. So if you don't mind going manual, you can pick up some of those great old lenses. And I talked to a guy, there was a guy at Wall Portrait Conference this year, and he had just got a 645Z, and he just said he loves it. It's just phenomenal. And he's using it, of course, for family portraits, wall portraits, things like that. And so, yeah, I mean, you're looking at investing 10 grand. And the problem, my struggle is, of course, is the ever-present struggle of lenses. I've got the Canon system, and it's great. And now you go to the Pentax and you got to change lenses and all that kind of stuff. So there's some ins and outs and thoughts, but hey, for the readers out there, I mean, for the listeners, excuse me, if you have a 645Z, if you've looked into it, if you've done any comparisons, if you have the 5DS, shoot us some emails, profotoshow@gmail.com, and let's share some thoughts on this. And then talk about it a little bit on the next show and see where it goes. In fact, you know, if you've got something to contribute, I mean, we're trying to build up the roundtables again and get the panels back going and get some new ideas going. So if you're interested in being on the show and you have some good stuff to offer, send me an email, profotoshow@gmail.com, and we'll consider you for the panel as well, because we want to diversify and keep the ideas flowing here as things go forward. Wait, I think I got him. Are you there?
Yeah, I'm back. We have wonderful internet here in South Florida.
So I kind of kept us cruising along, and basically we could go on all day about this, but basically I said, hey, let's have some listeners give some input. Let's share some ideas. Let's, as we keep building our panels here on the roundtable, let's talk about the potential of going medium format and where this is going, especially for those of us that are doing large prints. If you're doing large prints and doing wall pieces, let's share some ideas, because honestly, I know everybody's not into this, but I think being able to make really refined wall pieces, not necessarily the biggest, it's not necessarily about the size you make it, but making them appropriately sized decor for the wall, like we've been talking about for years on here, from the business perspective, I think that's going to be key. We've seen a lot of photographers, a lot of veterans in the past 3 or 4 years that have pretty much just dried up and gone out of business. They're just not there anymore because the 5x7s and 8x10s, the you know, events and the weddings and things like that, they're just not the same. And so I think those of us in the profession that really want to build that's got to say, okay, we have to make something unique. We have to make something that makes people go, wow. With that, let's jump in and talk about fall. So we kind of, you know, did some updates. We talked about the gear a little bit, and we're seeing that. We're seeing the compacts, the mirrorless stuff come into its own and getting better and better all the time. And as much as I have my eye on expanding into new gear and things like that, I find myself saying, I get bored of it a little bit. I like the tech, and sure, I'd love to have a 645Z because it really offers me something, but I'm over a new camera for the sake of a new camera. The camera is my tool, just like anything else. What I care about is the result that I'm getting on the wall. It's the finished image. It's going out there and really mastering the light and being able to make something that conveys the majesty and the beauty of whatever it is, whether I'm making a portrait or a landscape. And so let's talk about some tips for doing just that. Let's talk about how we can get ourselves outside of our ruts and step into something a bit more. And what I want us to do, Jason, is since we don't really have a large panel, we're not going to do lightning rounds so much as let's just go back and forth and share some tips, share some things that we've learned this past year or beyond that we maybe not haven't shared before about where applicable getting fall images, but really just in general things we can do to expand and for the photographers listening out there that they can put into practice, simple and easy. So I will start, and let's start with a fall tip. I'm really excited about the fall color, and I'm going to be taking a fall road trip, not a super long one, probably 2 or 3 weeks, and I'm hoping to take off in about a week probably. I'm having some work done on the truck. I got to have a new injector job done on the Duramax, and I'm kind of pulling everything together and getting things in order around the studio, and the new product releases are done. We have the new autumn light presets out, and so I'm going to go out and use them. I'm going to go out and see that light. I'm going to go out and get some of this fall color out here in the Northwest and see what I can do. One of the things that I learned in the past couple years with fall color is whether you're in Utah photographing the Red Rock or you're in Idaho and you have the maples, when you have fall color and the light is radiant, and really I think this is going to apply to any vibrant color, particularly, I think, in the reds, the oranges, and the yellows. What I find in digital, we often have a tendency to say, well, I'm doing a landscape, so let's crank up the saturation. And let's make that color pop. And that's good to a point, I think, as long as you don't overdo it. Balance is key. So I'll make images and I'll try and get them as good as I can in camera. Things like we talk about in exposed and photographics workshops. And I'll really try and nail it in camera. And then I'll say, okay, I have my raw file. And raw files, at least on the Canon side, tend to be a little flat. And so I'll go in and I might apply a preset or manually tweak it. Or if I'm getting dynamic range, but I want it natural, I'll pull out my natural HDR presets. Or I'll just kind of refine it. But I'm finding myself with color trying to be subtle. What am I trying to do? What's my visualization? What I'm getting at here is with fall color, don't overdo it. I dealt with this with the image that we were talking about earlier in Utah. And the color in particular in the reds on the red rock, you already have the red rock and then you had the golden sun coming down here. It was so red. I actually ended up kind of dialing back the reds, and it was a little bit of a struggle because what actually happened, and I see this in oranges and yellows and reds in particular, and of course it's probably going to vary by sensor, but it's almost like you overdrive those colors even without saturating. You start to lose subtle detail because it can't quite handle that level of color. You can't, Jason, you can't handle this level of color. So this is the problem we face. And I'm not saying that this is a technical deficiency so much as we're used to bumping up saturation. And I'd have these images, if the light's flat, no. I mean, you got fall radiant color in the trees, right? But if your light is flat or you're in shade, yeah, you're probably going to be bumping up that saturation a little bit to convey what you had in the real world. But if you have great fall light illuminated color or something like it, don't be afraid to dial back the saturation instead of going up. So I might increase the greens or I might increase the yellows a little, but then dial back the oranges so that we don't get this overpowering. Now, I don't know if you deal with this kind of color down in Florida a lot, Jason, but this is something I'm finding. I thought it was an interesting thing to mention because while we're used to going up in saturation, I've found on some of these images where I exposed them right and I had great color that actually going down a little bit, particularly not so much globally, but on particular specific color channels, gave me a better image because the colors became so overpowering.
Down here, we don't have that dramatic color that you'll have where you're at, but what we have is we have a little bit of subtlety. So you go out, we have a lot of green. That's
right.
That's kind of our thing. It's a lot of green in the Everglades. But if you can dial back the green, or depending on the image, look for those other colors that you find inside the grasses, inside the trees that you might not see otherwise. And those are the colors that you focus on as far as saturating and bringing out a little bit more. The browns, the little yellow tints that you find here and there, if you bring those a little bit, dial back the green, you start seeing a lot more of what the Everglades is about.
So I guess what we're dealing with here is while this came to my mind because of some of the fall color I'm dealing with, really, anytime we have a color that's so dominating and vibrant, as beautiful as that is, and honestly, I want that color to be vibrant, but at the same time, I don't want to overdrive it. And it seems like when we're colors, when nature's colors, I mean, let's face it, our cameras still can't reproduce nature in its truest sense. So you can have this incredible three-dimensional color and light and tone and line and all this stuff, and we're trying to bring that, like I talk about a lot, into the two-dimensional world. I think it bears note that we should stop and really think about the subtleties of the individual colors. What's the dominant color, maybe, is what we're getting at here, and then how can we work with it? So then you got your greens and the Everglades. Do you find yourself sometimes going into the individual channel, maybe tinkering with the hue to correct the green color to get it in the right mood that you're trying to convey, that sort of thing?
Yeah, it's based on whether it's sunrise or sunset or just a little before, a little after. Every single image from the Glades, I go in and I'll go to HSL, I'll go to the saturation, I'll pick the specific colors, I'll change the hues. Sometimes you need it in the clouds or in the sky, depending on the morning and your white balance and all of that. But yeah, I go in and I start selective. It's selective saturation. It's selective color. It's not selective colors in the 10 years ago that I'm glad it's gone phase.
Right.
But selective color is in you're finding that saturation that you want to bring out, that hidden color. right. that you make your image pop a little more.
And so I think the overarching tip to take from this is a lot of times we say, oh, we're doing black and white. And on black and white, we tinker around to bring out the black and white. And then we say, oh, we're doing color. Let's just apply a cool effect. And what we really need to be thinking about the language of color in a lot of ways, you know, I talk about the zone system a lot, and I know you're familiar with this because you've heard me talk about this. And so we talk about zones and exposure and placing your tone values. What I've been finding is that same concept really applies to the zones in your color. So I'll still expose for, let's say, zone 7. I want the rock in zone 7, let's say. But then I can take my visualization and my subtlety further, Jason, by thinking of the values of the colors, and you can actually start pre-visualizing. You can say, I'm exposing this for zone 7, or I'm exposing the sky at zone 7, but I'm going to bring that rock right there down to zone 6, not by darkening the exposure, but by dialing back the channel blue and taking in the light that's reflecting off it. And so I think if we can dig deeper into our post process, and this is one of the reasons I love our RAW processes, whether you're using Capture One or Lightroom, or if you're still using Aperture, is I feel like you miss out a lot of times, and I should include Camera Raw and Bridge in that as well. I feel like we miss out a lot of times if you're just editing in Photoshop. It's not that you can't do the same things, but they work differently aside from the workflow issues. I still get a lot of emails from people that are still just editing in Photoshop, and I'm kind of like, well, why would you do that? You're losing a lot of workflow time, and you actually are getting more control by working with the RAW file because you have every single bit of information in that RAW file. Now you can dig into your tones, your space, your position, your line, your color channels, and then delve into a whole nother level of tones within those color channels. And this is something we talked about that I dug into in depth and taught in the Sliders workshop, which is kind of Lightroom specific, but really goes beyond that, that we released this summer. So if you want to tinker with channels more and really start studying this deeper, go check out the Sliders workshop. But I think maybe we should stop and pause and think about our color channels a little more than we do. And maybe we should start doing that, Jason, even in the field when we're out there looking at the color and the light.
Yeah. When I'm out there, I'm seeing what nature's giving me, but I'm also seeing the finished product or what I think I can bring out finished. Right. Wise. And this is actually something that I see as a president of the camera club, where we have so many members. There are so many that are out there that want to know how to take that perfect picture, but they want to be able to go back to their computer, pop it up on the computer, and it's already that perfect picture.
Right.
They're missing half of the process, or maybe even more than half. They're missing that where they capture the image and then they come back and they don't know what to do with it.
And to be fair, oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm just saying that is a big deal.
They don't know where to go.
And that's right.
And I think, honestly, I mean, if your weakness is going to be in anything, I mean, if your strength is in something, it should be getting it right in camera, because that's right. To me, is that's the foundation. If you can get it right in camera, you can start applying the other techniques, because oftentimes it's not that you have to do a lot in post-production. I might spend an hour tinkering with an image and I haven't actually changed that much. I will be subtly analyzing channels and color and tones. I'll burn, I'll dodge. I mean, I talk about all this stuff all the time. So if I'm making a wall portrait, I'm going to spend a lot of time in post-production. It doesn't mean I'm changing things drastically in every sense. And so the closer I can get it in camera, if my light's really good, if my light's not flat, if I have radiant color, if I have a portrait that's beautifully lit, and I nail it in camera, then I've got a visualization now. I saw it, I've exposed it, I made it right. Now I have this visualization and I carry that through and I equal or even surpass that visualization in post-production because I have a great foundational image to work with. And so I think a lot of times people will say, well, you know, just whatever tool I have right now, whatever the plugin I'm using. And look, I make plugins, I make Lightroom presets, and they work really, really well, and they save a lot of time. But think beyond that. You know, I'll tell people will say, well, you know, I like to do my images manually, so I don't use presets. And I'm like, I'm the guy that makes the presets, and I still use the presets because I want to be able to get to my visualization. But then you don't have to stop there. If you're doing a wedding, if you have to do workflow, if you're doing 1,000 images, yeah, you might apply a preset and say, these look good. But the image that's going on the wall, I'm always going to get it to where, hey, this looks great, and then refine it even further.
Yeah, well, I use the presets all the time as well. What I'll do is I'll go on a shoot, I'll come back. Generally for landscape, I'll just apply a preset that I've got, and it's because there's certain things that I do to every image just to kind of get an idea of what I want. There's not a single image that that I can think of that I show online or that I've printed out that I just hit the preset one time and then that's all I ever do to it. Now you hit the preset, you kind of get that creative starting point, and then from there you move on and you refine even further.
And if I'm in a workflow mode where I'm dealing with hundreds of images, you know, from a reception or something, I might click a preset and leave it at that, and then I'll take the best ones and tinker with it. But it's funny, we do a lot of Facebook advertising for SimFX for the new presets and stuff. And so, you know, people get kind of inundated with a lot of this stuff. And my emphasis over at SimFX is quality. I mean, if I make a preset pack, I'm not trying to do something crazy or over the top or just, you know, make a new fad. I'm really building processing tools, and people will say, well, you know, I know what I'm doing, so I don't need that. Well, no, maybe you don't. You can probably do it manually, but I can take a pack, let's say like the new Autumn Light, where every single one of these has been engineered to help me help photographers in general fulfill a visualization with fall color. I can browse over those presets and say, wow, that was the visualization I was looking for, or that even exceeds it. And there's no way I'm going to try the thousands of possible combinations on every single image I edit that I could get by using a preset as a starting point or as an ending point.
Now, the other thing that you might fall into with going to one preset or something of that nature is that you don't want to get in a rut. It's easy to get in a rut in photography. It's easy to get in a rut when you're post-processing. It's okay digitally. I mean, pixels are free. You can punish those things if you want to. So
especially in a non-destructive environment.
That's right. Inside Lightroom, change it. Maybe look at something you would never think about doing, because you can always control Z and back out and start over. So
use your tools and learn from them are
great just because it gives you other ideas, things you might not think about otherwise.
Right. And just to be clear to the listeners, I mean, we say presets in particular, you know, I'm talking about Lightroom presets and things like that. But this same thing applies if you're using Nik, if you're using Topaz. Don't, you know, yes, take tools that professionals and people that have crafted tools have made and use them. But at the same time, don't be afraid to make your own tools. Don't be afraid to modify beyond that, because the goal is your visualization. And I always remind myself of that. When I'm making software, when I'm making tools and presets, I'm constantly reminding myself, my goal is not to sell people Gavin style. My goal is to give them tools to help them make their images better and fulfill their visualization. And so that's kind of the MO of when I'm making tools. You know, how can we mix? How can we match? How can this make people more efficient at making their images better? And punish those pixels so you can learn, but then learn to make an image in camera that's as fine as possible so that you don't have to punish the pixels to get that complete visualization. Because my goal on a wall print is the less I have to punish the pixels, the more natural and beautiful and radiant that light and that color is going to be. And there's a science and an art to all of this.
Yeah, it's always, always, always get it right in camera. Because if you start with something that's great, then you can make it, you know, fantastic. But if you start with garbage, you're going to probably end up with, you know, polished garden.
Right.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I know it's probably beat to death on podcasts about getting it right in camera, but take the time to do it. Take the time to get it right. Check your histogram. Check everything. Check anything you need to make sure that you've got the image that you're looking for.
Yeah, we can't emphasize that enough. I mean, I'm always telling people, learn zones, understand your histogram, understand the color. The magic happens out in the field. And let's face it, you know, we get all this software, but what we really want to be doing is being out in the field making great images anyway. So let's study that. I can get so passionate just sitting out there and spending an hour making an image and waiting for the right light. And I'll be in a place like Yellowstone and everybody's gone by the time I leave. I'm the last one to leave the boardwalk out in whatever geyser that I'm at, you know, because I'm watching the light. I'm studying it. I'm looking at it, how it reflects off things and off my hands and what it does to my camera sensor and everything's different. So I'm always trying to see what's happening with that. But let's move on. Let's not beat a live horse, because that is a very important horse. But Jason, do you have maybe a tip that you can throw out and maybe along our fall theme, but since you don't really have fall per se out in your neck of the woods, maybe you can speak to the people that don't have radiant fall colors starting to fall onto their lawn right now.
Actually, I have something that has really become apparent to me over the past year working with the Everglades is, and this will apply to fall color. It'll apply to any outdoor photography that you do, is when you're out there, you're on nature's agenda. You're not on your agenda. So you have to take what you're given.
Right.
You, and don't just, oh, it's raining, so I'm going to give up and I'm going to go home. No, you can find something to photograph. You can use long exposures in the rain to make it look misty. You can use those gray skies if you're doing fall color, because sometimes those colors will pop more with a gray sky. You just don't put the sky in the photo. Find something, go intimate, go inside, right, and look specific. So don't go out there. You can go out with an agenda. You can go out and say, this is what I would like to do, but be willing to change when nature says, nope, nope, this is what I'm doing and you've got to deal with it.
So be adaptable. And I think if to piggyback on that a little bit, there's a phrase I've been using in workshops. I was speaking for New Hampshire professional photographers this spring out in New Hampshire, and I'm kind of wishing I was there now because I bet it's beautiful right now. But a lot of videos and stuff this summer and working on some other projects. And I've got this line that I kind of been using that said, to get there's three ways to get great light. You take it, you make it, or you wait for it. And when it comes right down to it, what you just said is you take the light that nature gives you. That's And in general, with landscapes like we're talking about, that's how you have to do it. You take it. But if the light's not what you expect, if the visualization for the mountain isn't working, maybe you should be looking behind you at the flowers. And so expand your visualization, you know, be willing to change your subjects. Sometimes if I'm sitting there and I'm looking at the Tetons and it's all misty and gray and cloudy, I can take it, but that doesn't mean that it's going to be a really great image. So I can then make it illuminating with strobes and things like that. But the last time I illuminated the Tetons with speed lights, it took a lot of speed lights and a lot of drones, and it was just impractical. No. So you can take it, you can make it. And with portraits, a lot of times we're in a situation where, well, we can't come back next week. We're making a portrait. And so when I do a portrait, I'll try and schedule it, let's say for sunset or something, because I want that beautiful light. But don't use the, oh, I'm a natural light photographer, to not get great light. If your light is weak and flat, take the time to set up a field strobe so you get nice catch lights in their eyes, things like that. Take it, make it. Or you say, what I want is the Tetons today. That's what I want, Tetons. Give me the Tetons. I'm going to take it. But if it's not right, you can take it. You probably can't make it in that case, but you can wait for it. And that's what I did when we were talking about with Utah, is I kept coming back for years. I waited for it and I didn't release the image. You know, I'd get images and I'd say, nope, they're not good enough. I'm not going to do anything with them. I'm waiting until I get the right one.
It comes down to being prepared. Be prepared for what you want. Be prepared for what you don't get. When you go out and you see, I've got an instance where it was like the first field trip of the camera club, and we're all out there, and it's rainy, it's nasty, it's horrible.
Right.
And we were going to go do sunset pictures. And everybody was like, well, are we going to go or not? And I'm like, absolutely, we're going to go. I don't care if it's raining or wind's blowing or it's pouring or whatever. We can go and we can find intimate parts of the landscape that we can photograph.
Right.
We can find those blades of grass that are wet. We can find the little critters that are around. Well, we got there and everything was dull and drab and kind of just boring and plain. And I would say about people wanted to start leaving, and about 5 minutes after that, it's probably one of the most beautiful sunsets I've ever seen. So be prepared, be patient.
Well, and we have this digital world where we always have this instant gratification. So we assume that creation is going to just give us instant gratification too. And what I've learned is God doesn't always operate on my time. So take it, make it, or wait for it. Okay, cool. Let's see. How long have we been going here? You know, these are some good thoughts, and these are certainly some things that I'm going to be keeping in mind as I go out over the next few weeks and take a road trip. And I hope a lot of you are going out taking road trips this fall. I think regardless of whether your focus is weddings or portraits or landscapes or whatever, mixing it up and putting yourself, challenging yourself to different genres and different themes and different ideas and different techniques is a really great way to expand every horizon of your image making. And so with that, let's wrap up with a couple more quick tips, and then we'll go into a little pick of the week, and we'll wrap it up for the day so we can keep it relatively short and very, very sweet because Jason Elters is here. So,
that's right.
I'm going to take a couple tips, and you can actually find more of these on the SimFX blog. There's a real popular post that's been on there the past few weeks where I just kind of parse down some of my best tips to make us better photographers, short and sweet. So I'm going to come back to one that comes up a lot, and it's use space. use space, use space. Now, I get people and they'll send me emails or they'll be at workshops or something like that. And I'll look at their images and, you know, we talk about taking, making it or wait for it. We talk about these principles of making great images. And a lot of times I'll see images and I'm thinking, well, that's nice, but. And we all deal with this. Sometimes you get an image and you're like, you want it to be good so bad. And it's not that there's anything wrong with the image, but there's just nothing there. And it's just like, okay, so it's a boat on the harbor. And it goes back to my image in Utah that we were talking about earlier. It was beautiful, but it wasn't that image. It wasn't the one I wanted. And sometimes I just got to put it aside and wait. But what we can apply to this is use space when you're doing it. Don't get yourself into a position, because I'll see people and they'll get the right light. They'll finally get the right image and then they'll shoot it. And I'll be like, that's nice, but there's nothing to work with. There's no space. It's not going to scale well on the wall because it's going to be oversized or it's just going to be too tight on the frame. And when I'm making an image, and I deal with this a lot, I always say, okay, what am I framing? Ask yourself questions. This is something that I taught at Wall Portrait Conference this year in a session I did. Ask yourself questions. And we were talking in particularly about marketing and how we present our brand and things like that. But this also applies to our image making. Ask yourself questions about the image you want to make, about what you're trying to do, and give yourself answers in the field before you make the image. And in the case of space, I'm sitting there and I'm saying, what am I trying to photograph? Now, I'm going to ask myself more questions than that, but I'm going to ask myself, what does my frame going to look like? What do I want to encompass? And that's one of the reasons I love using a tripod, because I'll sit there with live view and I'll cut this tree out and I'll cut that tree out. But then I'll have this whole image and I'll leave some extra space. And I'm careful. It's not like I zoom out to a fisheye and just include everything. I mean, I want the perspective to be right. I want the feel to be right. And I want to be able to maximize my frame as much as possible and maybe not even have to crop it at all. But I'm going to leave myself space around the critical elements. And it always costs me when I don't. If I'm photographing the falls, let's say, And I get up tight and I'm like, yeah, I think that's what I want. Invariably, I'm going to come back later and be like, man, I wish I had some more space above or on the sides. On the other hand, if I leave a little space, if I leave 20% more space than I think I'm going to use, I might come back later and say, okay, I'm going to crop it now. Or I might come back later and say, that space should have actually been there in the first place. My perspective might change as I complete the process. So always give yourself a little more space than you think you need. The same applies to portraits all the time. And I learned this a lot doing wall portraits, because we're trying to make these big, glorious cinematic pieces on the wall. And when you go tight, you just end up with a tight image. This is with wildlife, with anything, you know, you get close and you got no space to work with. And it's like, okay, it's just another photo of a bear. There's no landscape. There's no space. There's no composition, really. It's just a dead center portrait of a bear. That's nice. I'm glad you didn't get eaten. But use, and so it's beautiful, but use space, because it will make your images better. And one of the number one things that comes up when people are sending me images is they're always cropping too tight. They're always cropping too tight. Use the space, then crop if you need to, but don't be in too much of a hurry to crop that image. Think about how you can use space. And when you use space, you're going to get into asking yourself other questions like, is there any clutter in the scene? What crap is in my frame? Why is that Burger King bag laying there? And why is there maggots coming out of it? Things like that. Questions that you don't really want to answer, but ask yourself the hard questions, use space, and make better images. Okay, Jason, give us a nice tip to wrap up this portion of the show, and we'll go into picks and wrap this up for the day.
Work the subject. Go with an idea that you have for the subject and make sure you try to capture that, but don't just stop there. I was out with a group recently and we stop and the sun's kind of setting and it doesn't look like it's going to do much. And then the sky starts lighting up and they take their single shot from the road and then they stop. Well, I took the same shot and then I walked into the glades and I took another shot and then I changed my perspective and I moved over to the left, moved over to the right, moved closer, further away, and I took those shots. And the image I got is unlike anything that any of the other folks were there, because they took their shot and they were done.
Right.
So don't be afraid to work the subject. Go with an idea, pre-visualize what you want, capture that, but don't just stop there. If you have time and you can, grow creatively while you're in the field.
Yeah, and I think that's great, because there's no better time to grow creatively. Yes, you should grow in post-production. You should grow in understanding your channels and your exposure and your burn and dodge and all that good stuff. But there's nothing like growing in the field, because it actually prompts you to grow in every other way. It prompts you to challenge yourself, to not be lazy, to ask yourself questions about your images, and ultimately to ask yourself questions about what kind of work am I trying to produce, and am I meeting the standard that I'm making for myself? So I think that's a great tip. Working subject. Go ahead. Sorry.
One more tip. I'm sorry. I have one more tip I want to add. My son is 7 and he plays the cello.
Nice.
He has been playing for right at a year now, and he's in the 4th year orchestra. So he's playing the cello exceptionally well.
Wow.
But we're in there. I'm in the class with him because he's in classroom with middle school and high school students. And so Kim and I, my wife, we go and we watch the lesson, and he has a wonderful conductor that said something to the entire class, and it's resonated with me. I just did a blog post on it, which is be better. Don't be a good photographer, be better. Don't be an excellent photographer, be better. Don't be fantastic, be better. Always be seeking to be
right.
Better.
Raise the bar, be better.
That's right.
Awesome. Yeah, well, and that's a great tip, because it's easy. Artists tend to be a little egotistical. You know, we want the accolades. We want an award. You know, look at me. And this is a problem that I think everybody has in various industries. But let's face it, most of us have sat and thought, man, I can't believe what a bunch of egotistical, self-focused people photographers are. And I'm sure that's been said about me, too. And really, I mean, let's be better. Let's slow down and not always pat ourselves on the back, but look for Kim Whitmire has something he says that always resonated with me. If you can't find something wrong with your image, I'm probably not wording this right, but basically if you can't find something wrong with the image you just made, there's probably something wrong with you. You know, keep making it better. So with that, let's go into a couple of picks, and I will go first. I've got one or two, but Jason, hopefully, as we've been talking, you've been furiously searching through your Amazon order history to find your favorite gadget for the day. But the first one I want to throw out there is going to be an expensive one, and I'm going to do two since I'm doing an expensive one. The first one is going to be the Phantom 3 Professional.
Yes.
And I got the Phantom 3 a couple months ago, and wow. Now, this is video, although it does 12 megapixel RAW files. They're not RAW files like out of our D4s or our 5D Mark IIs, but I think I could make a decent, 24-inch print out of them. I think there's quality there, and I've gotten some really amazing sunsets over the lake and over towns and stuff that you simply could not get, because my selfie stick... Jason's does, I think, but my selfie stick does not reach to 350 feet. And so this thing, if you want to see kind of what I'm using it for in particular, I get aerial views. I mean, I can do all kinds of stuff. I just have fun with this. You can scout for camp spots, all kinds of neat stuff. This thing is the most amazing piece of technology I've ever used. Here's this quadcopter, and it has a 4K camera on it, and you take it off, and it's sending real-time HD footage back to your controller in your hand as you're flying around with this thing. So I have a Nexus 7 tablet that I bought specifically for using with this. It sits on the controller on the mount. And so I'm flying around with this real-time view, and I've had that thing out to 3 miles and been getting that footage back. I almost lost it that time because the battery was so low. I had a headwind coming in, not because it lost itself, but, that's a story for another day. Bottom line is the technology in this thing's amazing. It's very easy to fly. It's very well stabilized. You put it up and you're getting great images. It's not like it's shaking all over the place and you got to be an expert. I'm not saying don't be careful, because this is a $1,300 unit. Although they have the standard version now, and I think the standard version is only like $800, and it still does 2.5K video. And so it's not quite what the Pro is, and it has a few other features, but really it's the same basic technology for under $1,000. And not only are you going to have a ton of fun with the kids with this thing, I mean, you lift it off, you park it at 20 feet, and you walk away, and it's just going to stay there. And if it runs out of batteries, it's just going to land itself. And you can now, they've just released updates, so you can do routing. So I can fly a course, let's say, at different altitudes, let's say to do a B cam, to do a fill cam on a piece of footage I'm doing for the YouTube channel. And so I can get an aerial view, let's say, of me walking through these trees that I'm photographing. And I'll start it and the camera is actually just following me along the path that I've predefined. This is an amazing piece of technology. It produces beautiful images. One of the things you are going to love with this is just the fluid video that it puts out. Gives a whole different perspective. And I'm actually really looking forward to these kind of things advancing to further generations. You know, we see that DJI actually just released a camera for their Inspire 1 series, which is the level above the Phantom. It's kind of the $3,000 version, but it's still a quad. They actually just released a Micro Four Thirds camera for this thing that has interchangeable lenses and all kinds of stuff. And so the potential there, and I'm thinking Everglades, man, I mean, the potential for landscapes when you're, you know, I'm not talking about putting yourself at satellite height, but the things you can do with landscapes and the views that you can get when you can just put yourself up above the trees are phenomenal. And we're going to see these cameras becoming more than just cool things with video. We're going to see high-end cameras that are very small being placed on these quality Micro Four Thirds, things like that, going on these drones in the next couple years. And we're going to start seeing the kind of quality that we can make 50, 60-inch wall prints from with these aerial landscape views that are absolutely breathtaking. And so you could do aerial landscapes, I think, with these that you wouldn't even necessarily know you were in the air. It would just seem like you were standing on a rock or climbed a tree above all the other trees. So much potential here. And I'm tinkering with the stills, but the still functionality, well, it's good for what it is nothing like my DSLR stills, but it's fascinating. I'm working with that, and I'm, of course, using that 4K video. If you want to see some of the video from it, head over to the new release that we just came out with last week, the Autumn Light presets at simeffects.com. And in the promo I put together for that, you'll actually see some of the footage I use where I'm flying over the fall leaves and things like that and seeing that come together. But really a neat thing, and, of course, a tax deduction, because it's a camera, people. So very cool. That's my high-end pick of the week, but it's so far great. Yeah, there's some caveats. There's some annoyances. DJI kind of dumbs it down, which in some ways is good. But for example, if you're too close to an airport, you can't. It'll be a no-fly zone, and it'll know it's there because of GPS. So there's a little bit of nanny state kind of stuff going on there. Not that I'm saying you should fly into the path of airplanes, but sometimes you're really nowhere near the air traffic path. And so it would be nice if they had some more overrides on some of these things where experienced user could disable certain settings where you need it to. There's, of course, other drones coming out to compete with this, like the 3D robotics is coming out with some great stuff. Hello. So a lot of live view HD 4K cameras, really cool stuff. That one, the new 3D robotics will carry the GoPro. It's designed more along those lines, whereas the Phantom 3 has a built-in 4K camera that is really quite good. So it's nice to not have to strap a GoPro or anything like that onto it. I take it, I put a battery in it, and I take it up, and I've got 20 minutes in the air just on that one battery. So very cool, and I'm sure we'll talk about that more in the future. Jason Eldridge, do you have a pick for us?
Well, actually, before that, I'm going to hold my shirt up here. It says flight test on it because my hobby is RC airplanes and quadcopters.
Oh, very cool. Is that a flame wheel? What do you have there? What's that quad you just held up?
Just a, let's see. It's from, this one's from Flight Test. It's one that you build together. You put it together very yourself. Cool. Last year, or year before last, I built a tricopter with the intention of doing all of this that we're talking about now.
Right.
I've got an APM module that's got the GPS lock and the return to home and all that stuff. And I was going to take it into the Everglades, but they have since banned all of
that.
That's
right, because it's national park, isn't it?
That's right.
The government will ruin anything good.
Yeah, that's right. You don't punish the individual, you punish everyone. So
here's the little secret, though. I mean, you talk about the Everglades is pretty remote. Nobody's in there. As long as you don't go too high, they're probably not going to know. And if you get arrested, just give me a call.
Yeah.
I've been there.
I'm a licensed guide there that I would.
You don't want to.
All of that. So
are there places in that area that are not actually in the park that you could go? There probably are, that are outside the park, but similar landscape.
There are, and I initially put the tricopter together for that purpose, but I never got the camera for it. Now, you can put it together for a lot cheaper than you can buy the Phantom, but trust me, I've put together two now, and they're both great. They both are wonderful. It's neat putting them together, doing all of that kind of stuff, but right. Functionality-wise,
yeah,
get the Phantom. Absolutely.
Well, and we talked about, you know, a couple years ago, we were engineering an airframe to make an Octo, a big one that would carry DSLRs and all that kind of stuff. And it kind of fizzled because, I mean, we actually designed this aluminum airframe from scratch. We had parts being machined. We did some testing, burned up some motors, things like that. And it never really came to fruition because I realized how much money we were putting into it and how much it was costing us. And at the same time, the small cameras were getting so good. The Phantoms kept getting better. The GoPros you could haul on it. And so I'm like getting to the point where, why do I need to put my DSLR on that? I mean, not that it wouldn't be cool. There's certainly a place to do that. But while you can go out and build one, and I'm actually thinking of building ones too, and I get like the little Proto X's and things like that, and me and the kids fly them. I mean, a great way to learn a drone is just to buy the little $30 drone because they're so much fun to play with. But it's a whole different – there you go. Is that a Proto or is that a – which one is that?
That's a Blade Nano QX. Yeah,
that's a good one too. And so these little, I actually have a bunch of them. I have a little, the Estes FPV drone. That's a small one. I mean, that's fun to fly. So all these neat things, but at the end of the day, I thought, well, I could build one and I kind of use those little ones to work up. And then I got a Phantom and I'm like, wow, this is way easier to fly than the little ones because it's all stabilized. I mean, you should still be careful and learn your ropes, but basically you take it up and it's going to stay in the sky. It's going to fly itself. It's not going to be all over the place. And so a lot of times people will build one or they'll get kind of a DIY one and it's very hard to get good images. If I want to fly a drone for fun and be racing it around and, you know, having drone wars or something like that, then I want a fun little one that I'm in total control of. But if I'm trying to make aerial video, I don't really want to have to think that much about flying. I want to think about composing and making a beautiful shot. So I'm thinking my flight path, I want to think less about how I'm going to keep this thing in the air. And so I kind of went the same way that you're talking. I finally said, wow, look at the footage out of this thing for $1,200. And I don't have to commit any other camera to it. It's all self-contained. I mean, I have a backpack for it and everything, and it's all in there. So I can walk out with this thing on my pack, and in any situation I'm in, pretty much, you can take this thing off and get your imagery, and it's really right. Cool. So,
and not to make this a drone show or anything, but
The drone show.
I just filed for an exemption from the United States government. It turns out that if you're a pilot, it makes it easier. And I've been a private pilot since 94.
Right.
And so I filed for an exemption so that I can start charging for specifically for doing aerial work for, you know, local businesses or down here. You've got the dive shops that have all the boats on the right. Water. You can go out and do all that kind of stuff. So that's one thing I'm working on. It takes 120 or more days to have the government.
Yeah, it's kind of a fiasco and with the FAA, and I know there's a lot of discussion of this in the drone world, and we could probably do a whole show on it. My bottom line is there's really no law on this. The FAA, there's no legitimate law that says you can't fly these drones. And so I'm a political activist, so I'm dealing with government bureaucracy all the time, and you know, I'm the guy that'll flat tell a government official, you have no credibility here. You have no law and you have no basis in this law. Go away and leave me alone. And that's how it is. That said, I'm not advising everyone just to ignore any rules and regulations. But the reality is the FAA, aside from their lack of constitutional authority as a federal government office, there really is no law. There's basically, from what I've seen for the most part, and I know there's things changing, so it may be that there's some stuff that's changed and you should look into how you want to handle this. But basically, they kind of drew up a paper and said, oh, look, we've made rules. And they actually have no legal authority. Nothing's been passed Congress, yeah, as far as I know. And so without turning this into a show about the nature of law and political things and how legislation works, which you can learn about on my political activism channel. If you want to go Google me, you'll certainly find that stuff. But the bottom line is that the legislators haven't made a law as far as I'm aware of, and the legislators don't have any authority to tell the FAA, you can just write up a paper on your computer whenever you want and it automatically becomes law. And so those are things to think about in terms of how we react and how we respond. But at the same time, if you're doing it from a business-wise, I mean, if you're charging people to go out and fly a drone, keep these things in mind, look into it. I would say from a liberty perspective, the government has no control over that. I would also say keep in mind your business and what you want to do and what battles you want to fight, because you can only die on so many hills, right?
Right.
Even as an activist, I've learned that. So anyways, but bottom line is we're kind of going down a rabbit trail here because the drones are fascinating. There's a lot of new stuff with them that people are still working out. And make your own decisions, do your research, because it's always changing. But more importantly, think about the potential, I think, of what you can safely do with these drones, what kind of imagery we can do, and how they can just help you be a better image maker. And I think even for non-commercial use, you know, you're making your videos to promote your portraits or your landscapes. I mean, I think there's a lot of potential in there for people's marketing because your brand and your visual impact on your website and things like that, I think they can really be used for that just on a personal level, which is of course perfectly legal as well. As long as you, except if you're in national parks and except if there's a full moon on a Friday. But anyways, okay, Jason, before I get any more into telling people why the government is out of control, give us a pick of the week.
Mine is simple. It's a hat, but it goes along with a tip. This one is called a Tilly hat. And the reason I like it so much is you can wad it up and throw it away and step on it and it comes back out. You can wash it, do all that kind of stuff. But I want to mention this because when you're in an environment like the Everglades, which is not a friendly environment, it's very hostile.
Right.
Because the best time to be in the glades is also the worst time to be in the glades, which is in the middle of summer. So you have to know your environment and be prepared for it. Hats. I've got bug suits. I've got thermal cells. I've got snake boots. I've got everything in the world.
Do you have one of those flat bottom boats with the big fan on the back?
No, I do not have one of those.
That's next. That'll be your pick of the week next time. It's just a really versatile hat then. It's
nice, comfortable, and you get it sized fit. It's got a lifetime warranty even against loss. I'm not sure how that works out.
What's it called again? A Tilly hat?
Tilly? Yeah, it's made for fly fishing effectively, but it's T-I-L-L-E-Y.
There we go.
You find them on Amazon. They're kind of pricey. They're $80.
But it's worth it, huh?
But absolutely worth it, and I look pretty cool in it.
Let's see. Put it on.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah, that's kind of your Everglades guy look. I can see that. That's pretty cool. All right, the Tilly hat. And, of course, I'll link these in the show notes because the show notes are still on profotoshow.net. And with that, since mine was high in dollar, I'm going to do one more quick tip that I've probably done before, but I think it's worth bringing up again because it goes back to safety and being prepared, and that is a radio. And I don't know, do you get cell service in the Everglades, Jason?
None whatsoever.
Okay, so this is important, and you know, as kind of a patriot guy who's like, well, what do we do if the grid's down, that kind of stuff. But even on an everyday sense, when we're out in the wild, you know, there's going to be times when you're not going to have cell service. And whether it's communicating with my wife at the trailer or an emergency situation, there's always radios with us. And we have a larger radio, a mobile in the super camper. But in particular, my pick today is the Baofeng UV-5R. This is a radio that's extremely widely used among, well, everybody. It's a ham radio, but if you don't have a ham radio license, it will operate on the regular FRS, GMRS channels with more oomph than you're going to get out of just the cheapy dedicated Motorola radio that's at Walmart. These are a 5-watt radio. And if you have a ham radio license, they're great for that. They even make an 8-watt version, and you can transmit on a lot more power on the ham bands. And so I recommend, you know, that if you want to get serious about it. But even if you just want it for the family, I mean, I'll have the kids use it. I'll lock it into an FRS frequency and we'll just transmit on that. And it is such a solid, nice radio. And here's the key thing, you know, with the battery, with everything, this thing's under $30. It's $28.88 right now on Amazon. This is a great radio. We probably have 6 or 7 of them of various iterations and models of it, but the UV-5R is a great one to go with. It is a phenomenal two-way radio, and you should have a game plan when you're out in the field. If for no other reason than communicating between your groups, if you're out camping or something like that, but also you should be prepared, you know, for the sake of your family and yourself when you're out in the field and things like that. A radio is a great way to do that, and it's a very inexpensive investment. Get two of them so that you have both ends covered.
All right, the next one I have, probably my last one for the night, is if I can get it. Hold on. Oh, I won't be able to get it. So. It is a low pro camera bag that we'll link in. It's a Sport AW, I think it is. Okay. Or it's the flip side. And what I like about it is in the, it's got a bladder in it, so you can always have water with you. It's very light, very durable. It'll hold a ton of camera equipment. And it's, I was a member of the Bag a Month Club there for a long time. And I've got a closet full of bags that I don't use at all.
Right.
When I got this one, I stopped looking because it is, like I said, you always got water with you. It's very durable. Now,
where's the water store?
It's stored in a side pouch in a camel, little camel back. So you buy the little camel backs or the pouches.
So it's designed to fit in there. Okay.
Yes. And it fits on the side. You can, because the Everglades is wet, which is why I started looking for another camera bag, you flip it around to the front and unzip it from the back and get your camera equipment. So you can leave it on your hips, flip it around, get your camera equipment out, and slip it back on your back.
Very cool.
So if you're in a wet environment or you don't want to stop and put your gear down and get it all out, then you can just flip it around and do that. So it's really neat. So it's a low pro. I think this is the 20 liter.
This is the, okay. Now I'm looking at the flip side 300, 400, but I don't see it talking about water in particular. Am I looking at the wrong one?
I think that this one's the Sport.
Sport.
And if you'll give me a second, I'll see if I can get this one unhooked, which is fantastic.
Let's see here. Is it blue?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, I still don't see it talking about a water pouch. So this looks really nice. I'm just a little confused. Like, do we have to buy the water pouch extra? Does it come with it? Or I'm not understanding the water side of it.
Okay, here we go. I think I got it now. So on the side, it even says little H2O on it. You've got a pouch right here.
I don't have video. Oh, there you go. There's your video.
Yeah, so you've got a little pouch on the side that you carry your bladder in.
Okay.
Not your bladder, but a bladder. And then it's got the hose that comes down on the strap.
Very cool.
And so you always have water with you. This you have to buy, but this is $9. So the bag, the little reservoir bag is $9.
And what's the actual model of the one you have? Because I'm still not seeing the water mentioned on this thing when I look it up.
Flip side Sport 20. Liter AW.
20.
AW. Yeah, 20 liter.
Oh, I see. Okay, so I must just not be reading enough in detail. So 20 liter. Okay, I see there's a 10 liter. Is that how much water it holds? No, it can't be that much water that it holds.
No, that's how much camera it holds. It'll hold my D4 with a 200 attached and the 200 with the hood on. It'll hold the...
Very cool.
That, the 24 to 70, the 16 to 35, the 105 macro, it'll hold lightning trigger.
Plus you got your water with you.
Yeah, and it's got a pouch on the front to shove all the bug spray and the other bug spray that you take, and then some more bug spray.
Excellent. Okay, so the flip side 20 liter, and it looks like there's a 15 and a 10 available too. I'm guessing the smaller numbers equate to a little bit smaller size.
That's correct.
Very cool. Well, we will link that in the show notes. Looks like a good little bag, and that might be something I need to look into because having water is right up there at the top of the list, even before having a camera.
That's right.
All right. Well, I think we're going to wrap for the day. We got some great picks. I hope we've put some good tips out there, and I know I've got some new ideas to kind of remind myself and think about when I'm out in the field. I'm going to be taking about 3 weeks on the road, no particular workshops or anything like that during this trip, I don't think. We're just going to take some downtime. I'm going to load the family up, my four kids and the wife, and we're going to hit the road and explore some fall color and who knows? Hopefully maybe this coming winter we'll do some longer trips and I'll go back east a little bit or something and we'll do some workshops or something like that. So stay tuned to the SimFX newsletter over at SimFX.com is where most of my content is coming out of. But there's still things posted to Pro Photo Show and stuff occasionally as well. I just find that I can only do so many things really good. So I'm emphasizing most of my content over on the blog at SimFX in the newsletter and stuff like that. So you can head over there and keep up to that. You can, of course, email the show, ProPhotoShow@gmail.com. Share your ideas and your thoughts and what you're learning about photography today. So Jason, I know we had a small panel today, but it was really fun having you on and chatting. We'll have to do it again. And I hope we were what's our time frame? I think we were within a pretty reasonable time frame. We're almost to an hour and a half now, but hey, that's not bad for a pro photo show. We've seen longer, right? So
we have.
Where can they find you? And do you have some workshops and ebooks and stuff like that? I think you might have had some presets and things like that that you sell on your site as well, don't you?
Yeah, it's been a while since I've dealt with any of the presets. So okay. the book needs to be revamped. Right now, I'm really working on the workshops. I've got one on December 5th this year. We'll be running
Excellent.
A 2-day workshop next year. I think it's in February. I may have a workshop in the Great Smoky Mountains June 2nd of next year. And cool. I'm working with an individual in the industry. I don't want to say his name right now, but he contacted me to do a co-host workshop with him.
Awesome.
And if I can do that, so far everything's working out pretty good, but once I get it nailed down and contract signed and all that, then I'll post it. But it's, he's one of the leaders in the travel industry. In the travel photography industry.
Very
so
cool.
I'm excited about that. So really doing workshops, training. I've got a Lightroom seminar that I'm going to do next year, and that's about it for me.
Awesome. Well, hey, appreciate you guys being here. You can, of course, find my photography work at simestudios.com or f164.com for my landscape work. And, of course, my tips and my videos, workshops like Expose and Photographics, a lot of stuff going deep on the things we've talked about today. And, of course, the presets and actions and all that good stuff. And all that is over at SimeEffects, SEIMEffects.com. So everybody have a good one. Go get some fall color and head over to the Pro Photo Show or the SimeEffects Facebook page and share your fall color images. And we will talk to you all next time on Pro Photo Show. Thanks, Jason, for being here. Everybody take care. Talk soon.
Have a good night, everybody, and be better.
Be better. Be better and raise that bar.